Thanks for tuning in for the March 30th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. For our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Paige Pennell on changes in seizure frequency and anti-epileptic therapy during pregnancy. In this week's featured interview, Dr. Elizabeth Emma Palmer talks about her study evaluating the diagnostic yield of whole genome sequencing in children with developmental and epileptic encephalopathies in whom an exome sequencing or a multigene panel was non-diagnostic.
Hello, this is Hallie Alexander from Wake Forest University. Today I'm speaking with Paige Pennell from Brigham and Women's Hospital regarding her recent work published in the New England Journal titled Changes in Seizure Frequency and Anti-Epileptic Therapy During Pregnancy. This is really interesting work. So tell us now, in light of this new data from your study, what can you tell us about the effect of pregnancy on seizure control in women with epilepsy?
So this study was very helpful to establish that pregnancy in of itself does not increase seizures. This is something that we did not know, and as highlighted in the American Academy of Neurology guidelines in 2009, there really had not been a study that had a control group to compare the seizure frequency changes to. And so in this study, we did have a control group of non-pregnant women with epilepsy, and we were able to show that when they were followed the same way, the same percentage of women had increased seizure frequency in both groups. So it was 23% of women in the pregnant group and 25% in the non-pregnant group when followed over the same period of time, the same way, had increased seizure frequency.
Great. Say I have a patient, a young woman with epilepsy, who wants to start a family. And for this example, let's say she's been seizure-free for the past year and she's taking lamotrigine. So she comes to your clinic saying that she wants to start a family. How do you counsel her on what to expect during pregnancy and the postpartum period, both in terms of her epilepsy care and her seizure control?
So I have the luxury of being able to book these patients for longer visits. And I know not everyone necessarily can always do that, but if possible, it is really worth taking the extra time. It's this critical juncture and the care of a woman with epilepsy that's really important. And a lot of it's spent in education and counseling because we really want it to be a partnership of the decision she makes. So I first talk about what is the baseline risk for major congenital malformations in the general population and remind them that no pregnancy is guaranteed a healthy outcome. And the baseline risk is about 2% of the population. And then I will tell her what are the rates overall for medications, seizure medicines in general, but then go into the very specifics of the medication she's on. So you mentioned lamotrigine, and that is one medicine that we have a lot of information on for lamotrigine monotherapy, and that overall the rates of malformations are just minimally slightly higher than the general population or really in the same range. I'll even get into more detail about findings from URAP that tell us if we start pregnancy at a dose higher than 325 milligrams per day, then there is a slight increase in the rates of malformations. And so we'll also talk about what dose she is on at the time and what dose she needs to keep her seizures controlled. I'll then talk about other things we follow. We follow the growth and development of the fetus. And then we also think about the risk of medication exposure throughout the entire pregnancy and what is the impact on fetal brain development. And again, we have helpful information about lamotrigine having little to no effect really on neurodevelopment. And so again, this can be reassuring, but again, I think it's important to give all the information that we do have. We'll talk about how important it is to begin folate prior to conception if she's not already on it and make sure that we give her recommendations for that. And what I personally do is I prescribe 1 milligram tablets. I find that the adherence is good with one tablet a day. And by prescribing it, I think it reinforces the need to take it every day. Of course, I have no data to say that for certain, but that's just what I have found in practice. And then I'll talk about how we will follow her throughout the pregnancy. So we'll work closely with our obstetrician and that we will need to get medication concentration levels approximately monthly. And the most convenient way to do that is usually at the time of the obstetrician visits. I personally will see them in clinic at least once per trimester, but manage this in between. Also, we'll explain to her that in response to those concentration changes, we will make dosage changes, but have to explain to her that we're really trying to maintain the same concentration. Because if you don't give that information, that can be pretty scary to be taking such a large dose at the end of pregnancy and the risk of harm to the child. So it's sort of important that they understand the decision-making behind that. We'll also talk about following with obstetrician. We'll include a detailed structural ultrasound by them at 18 to 22 weeks, as well as the usual care. So I also like to take this opportunity to discuss with her her plans for breastfeeding and let her know that if she chooses to breastfeed, that we would strongly support it. She would get the similar benefits to other women who are breastfeeding, as well as her child. We do know from studies we've done that the amount that the infant gets into their system is relatively low. For lamotrigine specifically, the serum concentration in the infant is about 30% of mom's concentration, which is actually a lot lower exposure than during pregnancy. But more importantly, the prior need study led by Dr. Kimford Metter actually, in that study, we were able to demonstrate that children that were breastfed actually had better neurodevelopmental outcomes than the children who were not breastfed, despite the fact that the mothers were on seizure medications. Additionally, at the end of the visit, I like to also provide the woman and her family members who are with her printed information, because it is a lot of information to really keep in mind after they leave the room.
Excellent. I like that summary there, especially the fact that you included that they need printed information. I think that's a good point. So I'm just going to summarize then. So when you're seeing a young woman with epilepsy who's talking about wanting to start a family, the things that would be important to include in the visit would be to go over the risk of birth defects regarding the medication that the patient is currently taking, and, you know, specifically being sure to relate that to the overall baseline risk of birth defects in the general population. If known, you also would want to talk about the effects on neurodevelopment even after birth. You would want to definitely make sure to start them on a folate supplement. In your practice, you like to use 1 milligram a day. And then you're going to talk to the patient about what to expect in terms of monitoring of their epilepsy, including potentially monthly drug levels and dose changes, and then review breastfeeding at this opportunity. So there's a lot to go over at these visits. But now I'm going to make it a little bit more complicated. So now she tells you that she actually wants to try to come off of her medications prior to getting pregnant. Now, how do you counsel the patient?
So this is another reason why the preconceptional consultation visit, as I like to call it, can actually take quite a bit of time. So not only is it education, but also to address any questions they have. And indeed, that is a common question. And every patient, as we know, is different, and epilepsy in particular is so heterogeneous. So it's an opportunity for me to really take a deep dive into their past history to make sure I have clearly classified their seizure types and their epilepsy syndrome. For instance, what if there actually is a suggestion that they have psychogenic non-epileptic seizures but have never had the full diagnostic workup? And then for the epilepsies, you know, most of them, if they're on medications as an adult, they're usually going to have to continue the medications as an adult. So I would say it's quite a rarity in my practice that we are able to safely remove all medicines. But I look at what medications they responded to before, what doses, what their EEG showed, et cetera, to really try to figure out what is the best treatment with the lowest risk to the fetus, but keeping their seizures controlled. And that's where I really talk quite a bit to the woman about the risk of seizures during pregnancy. So we know that convulsive seizures are particularly risky to all patients with epilepsy, but also there might be even increased risk during pregnancy, as suggested by some studies coming out of the UK, that during pregnancy, there is a particularly elevated risk of SUDEP, sudden unexplained death of epilepsy. And of course, that's loss of two lives if that occurs during pregnancy. Even if she has other seizure types with impaired awareness, something as simple as a fall, that blunt trauma can actually cause abruption of the placenta. So I talk about the risk of seizures versus the risk of medications and really get into the details of which medication is appropriate for her treatment to try to provide reassurance. If it is possible for her to come off medications, or if there is a possibility, then I like to do prolonged EEG, such as an ambulatory EEG, sometimes before coming off medications, but definitely after they're off medications, as well as ask them to wait at least 6 months before conceiving to see if it is possible that she can remain off medications. And we talk about what would we do if her seizures recur, and during the setting of pregnancy, what our medication options would be to treat quickly during that time.
Okay, thanks for reviewing that. You know, there's so many specific scenarios that we encounter when we're managing pregnant women with epilepsy. So I'd love to keep kind of picking your brain about several different scenarios, but unfortunately, we should start wrapping up. So before we go, what would you say are three or four clinical pearls that you tell your residents about this topic, or maybe the three or four things that all neurologists should know?
Well, the first thing I say is expect the unexpected. So over 50% of pregnancies are unplanned in the United States, and unfortunately, the numbers are as high or maybe even higher in our women with epilepsy. So once a female reaches puberty, I think it really is important to begin them on folic acid daily, no matter what their sexual activity is or their contraception, but also to have the discussion about contraception and how important it is to have planned pregnancies. Another thing that I think is sort of top of the list is letting them know that we do have differences. This is fortunately not the 1990s anymore, and now we can practice evidence-based medicine. We know that some medications are particularly proven to be safe during pregnancy, and some are proven to be particularly high risk for malformations and for autism and neurodevelopmental delays such as valproate. And it's really important to think about that, again, long before they're considering a planned pregnancy. Another thing is, it's interesting that our goal during pregnancy is not to make someone seizure-free who has never been seizure-free. So sometimes I see this idea black and white, like, well, we have to stop all the seizures, but we know that a third of our patients have drug-resistant epilepsy, and we're not going to make them seizure-free during pregnancy. So don't over-medicate, like don't keep throwing extra medications at them because they're still having two focal impaired aware seizures a month if that's their baseline.
Excellent. Those are all great points for us to remember when managing pregnant women with epilepsy. Again, I've been speaking today with Paige Pinnell regarding her recent article in the New England Journal titled Changes in Seizure Frequency and Anti-Epileptic Therapy During Pregnancy. Thank you again for your contributions to the field on women's issues in people with epilepsy and for being with us today.
Thank you, Hallie. I really enjoyed this conversation.
This is Stacey Clardy, and today I'm speaking with Elizabeth Emma Palmer of University of New South Wales, Australia. Emma is a clinical geneticist and the author of a paper on genetic testing in epilepsy. It was available online in the February 10th, 2021 issue of Neurology and has the long but descriptive title of Diagnostic Yield of Whole Genome Sequencing After Non-Diagnostic Exome Sequencing or Gene Panel in Developmental and Epileptic Encephalopathies. Thanks for joining us, Emma.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to learn more about your paper and your thoughts on how to approach evaluation, because I really need a better schema to approach genetic testing. It seems so overwhelming when it becomes apparent in the course of a visit that I'm having with a patient that we're going to pursue genetic testing in terms of where to start, how much does it cost, how to get coverage. So it really comes up for many neurologic conditions, honestly, not just epileptic encephalopathies. But as far as neurology is concerned, it seems to me that the epileptologists, especially the pediatric epileptologists as a field, have been leading the way in outlining algorithms for genetic testing, specifically which genetic approaches and tools we should use first. Your paper in particular serves to highlight the strengths of different approaches and considerations regarding the interpretation of any genetic testing. But first, we should carefully define epileptic encephalopathy, right? So according to the International League Against Epilepsy, the definition of an epileptic encephalopathy requires a drug-resistant epilepsy for a minimum of 6 months, plus seizure onset accompanied by adverse impact on development, such as developmental stagnation or regression, and at least one EEG that's significantly abnormal with diffusely poorly organized background and marked by hemispheric activity. So with that definition in mind, Emma, if I've just seen a child with a suspected epileptic encephalopathy, what are all the options currently available for me to investigate for a genetic etiology? And can you explain what each test is actually studying in terms of, you know, their entire unique genetic makeup?
Sure. I think it's really hard for all of us, even as clinical geneticists, to keep up with the rapid changes in genetic testing. So sure, I can walk you through the options from simplest to most complicated. Well, the first option, and actually when I started in genetics, this is all we had, which was that you could look at an individual gene. So do individual gene sequencing. And I would say we don't need to completely throw that out. So sometimes my clever neurology colleagues will say, I know what this is. Like, I know that this is Dravet due to SCN1A. And so there's an argument then that you could still just go straight to that gene test. And in fact, I think you really need to still pay due to your clinical acumen. So if you suspect a certain gene or a short list of certain genes based on your patient's clinical presentation, it's really important that you check in with your lab and say, how well is that gene covered by this test? So for example, some, you know, you may have a massive gene test, but actually the one gene you really want to look at isn't well covered, and then that's a waste of money. So having that two-way conversation with your lab, that's my first recommendation. But for most patients, their presentations are so overlapping that you're really looking at using these new genetic technology, which has lots of different names, massively parallel sequencing, next generation sequencing, or high throughput sequencing. And all of that means that you're looking at more than one gene at one time. So there are three main types. The first is called a multiple gene panel. I call it MGP in the paper. So that is looking at lots of genes in one go that are known to be causal of your patient's phenotypes. But labs vary hugely in the quality of the curation of that gene list. So that's something to really look at. And a good guidance, a good tip, I would say, is to look at the global curation teams. So for example, the ClinGen team in the US and the PanelApp team in the UK, Australia. So what did they recommend? So you've got a team of people looking and saying, okay, these are the best genes to look at.
And I could find that on the website, right?
Yeah. So for ClinGen, you can look that up, or you can just Google Panel App, PanelApp, and get to those gene lists. So that's a good backup. Or speak to your lab and say, are you using these kind of curated gene lists? The second approach is to go more unbiased. So the thing with a gene panel is it's only as good as the genes that were included at the time. But we're still in this period of huge genomic discovery. So you may do a gene panel, and then it's reported without a diagnosis for your family. And then the week after, they discover a new genetic cause, and that wasn't on the panel. So even though that answer was in your patient's DNA, the panel didn't pick it up. So if you move to more unbiased tests, that's exome and whole genome sequencing. With exome sequencing, it focuses on the 1% of our DNA that encodes for the coding regions of genes. So that's a much smaller amount of DNA than your whole genetic code. But in reality, actually what most exome sequencing does is uses a gene panel approach. It just filters on a gene list. But it has that ability that if you don't get an answer right now, you could go back in some months or some years and say, hey, could you reanalyze that exome and look at the genes that we now know are causative? And that would pick up the answer if it was there all along. And then the last one, and I guess what our paper was really trying to explore, was this sort of last frontier testing of whole genome sequencing. And that is currently very expensive because it looks at the entire DNA code. So not just the 1% of our DNA that codes for protein, but also the introns, so the bits between our genes, the regulatory regions around the genes, as well as your mitochondrial DNA. So not just your nuclear DNA, but your mitochondrial DNA. And the reason that that is good is it has the potential to pick up more complex changes in an individual's DNA that could cause a genetic condition, such as complex rearrangements when one bit of a chromosome is flipped over and that interrupts how a gene is expressed, or kinds of genetic variation where you have an expansion, so like a triplet repeat expansion in a gene, and that's not well picked up by the other kind of tests.
That's a fantastic explanation, and it raises a lot of points to me, which are, you know, in some cases, you really are almost price shopping. If you have several separate components, is it better to do it that way, or is it to go for the broader upfront? And these things are all changing all the time, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it varies depending on, you know, in Australia, it varies from health service to health service, you know, what you can access, and also the turnaround for that. So if I've got a critically ill patient in ICU, I want the best possible test as quickly as possible. And that's what I'll go out all out to try and get. But for my stable, older patient, where my family that I see is really worried about incidental findings, or, you know, the cost is just prohibitive and it's not covered by our health insurance, then you might look for another test that's best in that situation. So there's not one size yet that fits all.
Agree. And what you're not saying as much or focusing on there too is part of the cost that you're really paying for here, right, is not just the raw data, but you're actually paying for the expertise to understand how to interpret that. And that could vary tremendously from lab to lab as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why building up those relationships with your labs is really good, because you need to know that you can trust your lab and that they're going to do the best possible job, because that's actually the expensive bit. It's the human power to do that analysis and keep abreast of the literature. And also that kind of nebulous line between what's clinical and what's research. So obviously this was a research paper, and part of the answers we got for our families were because we really pushed that research. So we, you know, I identified a variant in a gene. It's a brain expressed gene, and gee, it's, you know, it's a variant that I can't see in the normal population. And all my predictors would say that would affect the function of that protein, and it's a really interesting protein. I know in rats it's important for brain development, so I go all out. You know, I put that variant with the family's permission onto international matchmaking sites, and then we build up clinical cohorts and we get scientists to come and do the functional studies.
And that's important for clinicians to know on the other side of that, that, you know, a negative result or a whole bunch of variants of unclear significance should really be tucked away. So, for example, when I do get sort of maybe the inexpensive panels of genes for some of my patients, I'm not a geneticist, but I will write on there, okay, these are variants not thought to be pathogenic or relevant right now, but keep this printout and tuck it away in your top drawer and hold on to it, because that may change. Is that okay advice to give them?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, this question of reanalysis, like when we should do that and how often we should do that and how we should do that, that's still an unknown. So that's a very pragmatic approach you're taking. And I think that's really right, because if we give families the impression that a gene test is like, you know, a test for anemia, you either have it or you don't, and it's a clear-cut answer, then that's the wrong impression. You know, it's a large part of my counseling when I'm ordering a genetic test is explaining how little we know, and that we often will get these variants of uncertain significance, and that time and more studies is needed and often will clarify that. And I guess that's what we showed in our study, because taking it stepwise, it started originally with an exome sequencing study, and we looked at exome sequencing and we got an answer for half of our families. And that's, again, research show that was with some new gene discoveries. But then for those half that we didn't get an answer, we wanted to say, okay, so let's do whole genome sequencing. How many more answers do we get? And we increase the diagnostic yield further. So for that original cohort, we now have an answer for 3/4 of those families.
So that's a fantastic explanation. And you're leading me to the question now about your paper. So tell us exactly what you did in your paper. How many patients did you study? And what were the comparisons you made? And what did you find when you're looking at all these different options for genetic testing?
Okay, sure. So this research was part of my doctoral thesis studies, and we started with a cohort of just 30 families. And in a prior paper, we looked at trio exome sequencing, and we got an answer for half of those families, so 50%. And then we went on and looked at applying trio whole genome sequencing for those 15. So the 15 families that hadn't got an answer for the whole from the exome sequencing. And just this process boosted diagnosis further. So we reached an answer for half of those undiagnosed patients. So in effect, getting an answer for 3/4 of those children with DEE. But just to kind of go down to the granularity, the process of moving from exome to whole genome sequencing, for 15 of those kids, the answer was not at all evident in previous genetic testing. So not on chromosomal microarray, not on exome sequencing, not on metabolic tests, because they were complex chromosomal structural rearrangements, like a little bit of a chromosome flipped over, affecting the expression of a gene. But for another 5, the causal variant was actually there in the exome sequencing data. It comes back to this reanalysis question, because at the time we didn't have enough evidence to call that as being the answer. But in the interim period, there was enough clinical or pathophysiological evidence to say this is the answer. So that, you know, really highlights for me that it's not a closed book. You need to go back and think about reanalysis. And then the other cohort was 15 families, and they'd never had exome sequencing. We did a gene panel, you know, because pragmatically over the time of the study, you know, we're clinicians and that was what was available to us. And when we moved from gene panel to whole genome sequencing, that boosted the diagnosis by 68%. And that was because there were variants in genes that just weren't in the gene panel. And that is because of the rate of gene discovery. And that was particularly true for patients that were more complicated. And by that, I mean patients where the onset of their seizures was beyond the neonatal period, or they had other organs involved, like they were someone who maybe had dysmorphic features or complex neurological presentations, movement disorders, or multiple organs involved. And that's really where it shows that there's this huge overlap between genes causative of DEE and genes causative of other neurodevelopmental conditions, intellectual disability, autism, for example.
There's really a lot in what you said there. As a clinician, what I'm hearing is if I do still strongly suspect that something's genetic, not to let go, not to be discouraged on the first or even second round of genetic testing, which I think is really quite important, right? To be patient. It's hard to know if outside the research setting when to push, right? When to go for more.
Yeah. And you know, that's, we need that research. We need to say what's the cost effective approach, like how often should we be offering reanalysis?
Do these results frequently change your approach clinically?
I have a view on this, which is a view from being a geneticist over many years. And I think those two things do need to be looked at. Like, first up is the whole cold, hard clinical implications. And, you know, we do see absolutely occasions where genetic diagnosis, my neurology colleagues completely changed their management, you know, from choosing one antiepileptic over another to, oh, this is a metabolic condition, there's a particular targeted, you know, diet-based therapy now. Or, you know, on the imminent horizon, knocking on our doors is clinical trials for gene therapies and truly targeted therapies. And we'll need to know for those kids what their genetic variant is, and not just what gene it is, but how that particular genetic variant affects the protein. So does it cause a loss of function of the protein? Does it cause a gain or a change in function? That's that nitty-gritty of that detail is so important for getting truly targeted therapies. But from a more holistic, integrated view, I can honestly say that for each family, a genetic diagnosis has made a difference. And for some, that's not immediately what we might think of. Like, one example I would give was a family where they were in and out of ICU with their daughter. You know, their lives are really on hold. And when we got a genetic diagnosis, it was of a, you know, terrible progressive metabolic condition. And we knew what the natural history of that was. And that was, of course, really challenging for the family. But they actually said that helped them to step back and say, okay, so now we focus on her quality of life. And we're going to take that more palliative but careful consideration of what we do. And we're not going to insist that she comes into ICU each time. So for that family, that closed that diagnostic odyssey that they'd been on, wondering what was the cause. Could there be something that we're doing or we're not doing? And another mum, I really think about this a lot, she said, now with a genetic diagnosis, you've given me at least 15 minutes of each day back, because that on average is how much time I spend wondering what could have happened in the pregnancy or that I did do or I didn't do that caused my child's condition. And now you've given me an explanation and I know, and I can connect with support groups and I can see more information into the future. And I know what's the chance of it happening again if I were to have another child. And all of that information is very powerful, but can also be very challenging. So it needs to be wrapped around with genetic counseling and support.
Yeah, you make a very, very compelling argument. And there's even a piece in that argument for me to advocate with the insurance companies for coverage, right? To the point of, you know, does it allow someone to change the approach to care, even though that's tragic? You always have to sort of think of that angle of the equation when you're advocating often with payers. So you have given me, I think, all of the the good arguments that I need to justify this for my patients. And so, well said, I agree. Well, thank you, Emma, for sharing your findings and educating me, all of us in general, about the role of genetic testing. I know we spoke specifically about the DEEs, as you call them, the epileptic and developmental encephalopathies. This has been really helpful for my entire practice, so I really appreciate it. Once again, I've been speaking with Emma about her paper released February 10th in Neurology with the long but descriptive title of Diagnostic Yield of Whole Genome Sequencing After Non-Diagnostic Exome Sequencing or Gene Panel in Developmental and Epileptic Encephalopathies, again with Elizabeth Emma Palmer of the University of New South Wales, Australia. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features a study on the association of disease variables with white matter hyperintensities on MRI in patients with behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia and patients with Alzheimer's disease, as well as an article on the publication rate of clinical trials that evaluate post-stroke motor rehabilitation and the consistency between what was registered in the trial registry and what was reported in the manuscript. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.